Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Deborah Freeman. I serve as Mr. LaRouche's national spokeswoman. And on behalf of LaRouche PAC, I'd like to welcome all of you on this bright, sunny day in Washington to today's seminar and webcast. As you know, this webcast is being broadcast internationally in capitals around the world. As citizens everywhere, both inside and outside the United States, share in the sentiment that, in the words of one very wise man, we might be out of the bushes, but we are very far from being out of the woods. There are many things that we will address in the course of today's proceedings and much discussion that we can have. But given the urgency of the international crisis, given the urgency of the domestic crisis, what I would like to do, really without any further discussion or introduction, is to present to you Mr. Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you. I shall devote the presentation preceding the question and answer discussion period to the most crucial issue facing the United States government now and to the world as a whole. And the issue is bankruptcy. The fact of the matter is that the United States is bankrupt. The U.S. system is bankrupt. The U.S. government is bankrupt. And every part of the world is also bankrupt. Not only does this state of bankruptcy exist, but the moment at which the decisions have to be made to bring this problem under control is now. That's why the priority. The other aspect of this thing is that very few people, including the present administration of the United States, current president's administration, does not know how to deal with this problem. And therefore, that's the hole that has to be filled immediately. And therefore, I shall indicate some of the essential ground rules under which the emergency policy of the United States must be crafted to assure the success of the Obama administration. And in the process, to ensure that nations such as China, Russia, and others around the world do not tumble into a collapse in the meantime. We are on the verge, not of a simple bankruptcy, but of a general chain reaction collapse globally, comparable in form to the breakdown crisis in the middle of the 14th century, the so-called New Dark Age. Only this time, the threatened Dark Age, while immediate, is not merely in Europe. It is worldwide. There is no part of the world which could escape a Dark Age unless the United States itself, the United States government, takes the actions now under the leadership of its president, which put the world through bankruptcy reorganization before a dark age closes in. China is ready for chaos. India is somewhat behind that in time schedule. But a general collapse of the planet will hit India too. Russia is on the verge of general bankruptcy. Every part of Europe, including the British Empire, thank God, is on the verge of bankruptcy. Yeah? And the time has come, therefore, to understand what to do. Most of the proposals which I hear from around the U.S. government itself, that is from influential circles around government as well as those who are coming into government, is that they really don't understand the problem. They understand many aspects of the problem, but they don't understand the problem, and therefore their tendency would be to make a mistake. Now, one of the big mistakes is this. We have a president who's just been elected and installed, inaugurated. He must act now because he's at the high point of his ability to act. If he postpones these questions or tries to approach them gradually, certain evil things can take over and remove from his hands the ability to take the kind of action which he might be able to pull off now. If he's not able to pull it off, if he doesn't get the support to pull it off, then we're all in trouble, and the world as a whole is in trouble. But if he takes the right action, takes them promptly, and proceeds with resolution, as I think he would, then we can make it as a planet. And what the United States does in that direction is crucial and will be decisive. First of all, the policy has to be to put the United States system into bankruptcy reorganization. Don't fool around with this reform, this adjustment, that adjustment. Forget it. Put it through bankruptcy reorganization now. That means put the Federal Reserve System into bankruptcy reorganization. That's one of the first necessary steps. Put the Federal Reserve System into bankruptcy organization. And it deserves that after what it did under Alan Greenspan and what this poor schnook who's now took Greenspan's place is doing and not doing. The system is bankrupt. What has happened recently under the Bush administration and under the Congress, remember the leadership of the Congress is the place that made this a real chaos. Back in July 25th of 2007, when I forecast a general collapse of the system as coming on immediate, we still had room to get out of this mess without too much drastic action. That is now no longer possible. Due to what happened in the Congress, including what poor Barney Frank, who is the scapegoat of the century. I think he wanted some success, and he's made it as scapegoat of the century. Everything that was done in terms of dealing with this crisis was wrong. What was bad was made worse. We bankrupted ourselves with this bailout policy. The bailout policy was, in my view, unconstitutional and illegal and warrants impeachment actions against those who are responsible for initiating it and misleading and panicking the population into getting their representatives to vote for it. This was a crime against humanity. There should have been no bailout. What's the alternative? The banks are bankrupt. Firms, financial houses are bankrupt. So what? If you engage in gambling and you incur a gambling loss, you're supposed to eat it. You don't get to the government to get a bailout. You don't get a second life. Where else? I mean, guy says, I got good news for you, mother. I'm bankrupt. Why is that good news, she says? Because the government's going to bail me out. What kind of law is that? It's going to take away the pensions of our widows and orphans and so forth, and that's going to bail us out. No. That's immoral. It's unconstitutional. It's insane. So therefore, what we have to do is immediately is put the entire system to a bankruptcy reorganization. The best way to do it is to act on the Federal Reserve System, because we created the Federal Reserve System. And we want to keep a separation, as Hamilton laid it out, between the functions of the Treasury Department and those of banking. Our affection is devoted to state and local chartered banks under bank rules which we had with Glass-Steagall. That's the way it should be. Now, what's happened is in this corrupt mess which the Congress has created, remember the majority of the Congress is responsible for this. They did it. So don't say that the Congress says to the President, you trust us. The President cannot trust the Congress after what they did. They voted for this swindle. You're going to trust them? It's immoral. They voted for it. No, the President has to take the leadership as the chief executive and leader of the nation in the action from the presidency, which must demand support from the Congress, with the support of the people, and ram through an immediate reform. A reform of the U.S. Federal Reserve System, among other things. What we have to do, is we have to protect the legitimate claims in the banking system, the legitimate functions of the banking system, and forget the illegitimate functions. Cast them aside. Cancel all bailout. Cancel it. No bailout. The only thing you do is you put the Federal Reserve System through bankruptcy. And by putting it through bankruptcy, you put it under bankruptcy protection, not bailout. Bankruptcy protection. Then you conduct an assessment of the situation of the bank, like a bank holiday procedure. Those elements which correspond to legitimate functions of chartered banking will be protected. Those functions which are because of the repeal of Glass-Steagall, are concluded in this, will be canceled. They will be simply put into a freeze to assessment. Because we must save the chartered banking system, which is, in a sense, for its history, a constitutional feature of our system. National chartered banks and state chartered banks of the type which take deposits and make reasonable, secure investments with those on behalf of those deposits, which are entrusted with money passed through the federal government through the creation of currency under the authorization of Congress, will go through that. We have to then rebuild the U.S. economy. Now, for example, take a particular point. We have a fraudulent measure of the now in force in the what is and what is not valuable. In terms, the economy is not productive now. We're in a collapsing economy in general. It's true also in Europe, it's true in the world at large. We have to force investment into areas which are productive. Now, Greenspan's standards of productivity are fraudulent. Forget Greenspan standards. We're talking about physical standards. We're talking about standards of performance in production, productive values, per capita per square kilometer. We're talking about health care. We're talking about pensions. We're talking about production as such, physical production, essential services, health care services, this kind of thing. And those things have to be protected and promoted. We are now operating, in point of fact, as a nation, we're operating below break-even in physical terms. We're a bankrupt nation. We need bankruptcy protection. We go to our federal government for bankruptcy protection. We put the banking system under protection in bankruptcy. We put the Federal Reserve System into bankruptcy. We take and proceed to an act, which a National Banking Act. We put all the essential functions of banking under protection of a National Banking Act system, a Hamiltonian national bank. We use the national bank as an instrument of credit, which absorbs the Federal Reserve System, because the Federal Reserve System is bankrupt. And it needs bankruptcy protection. We put it in bankruptcy protection under the creation of a National Banking Act, a Hamiltonian national bank. Then we take national credit, we take what is worthless, we call it worthless. We classify as it worthless, as in bankruptcy. We put it out of its misery. And banks which are bankrupt, but which are useful as in their function as chartered banks, will keep their doors open, will maintain their functions, and we will generate federal credit as a source of lending power to get the economy moving again. We will build agriculture, we will build infrastructure, especially infrastructure. Now, well, the other problem we have here in trying to solve this problem is the fact that over the past period, especially since 1968, the United States has been functioning at a loss in terms of basic economic infrastructure. That was the year where Well, let me explain this, because most, again, you're dealing with an area in economics which most economists know nothing about. That's why they call them economists, I guess. That a modern economy is based in its progress on two things. It's based on technological progress, scientific and technological progress, number one. Because if you don't increase the productivity of a population per capita and per square kilometer, the human population uses up some of its resources and becomes poorer and poorer and poorer. And therefore, you have to compensate for this for large-scale investments in scientific and technological discoveries and progress in order to increase the productive powers of labor per capita and per square kilometer in the total territory. This requires scientific progress. As you go to scientific progress, you're going to capital intensity. That is, you make investments in machine tools and scientific technologies, in agriculture improvements and so forth, that sort of thing, which have a life, a useful life, where you use these investments up by wear and tear. And these periods range from a period of a few years in terms of relatively short-term investment to up to, in industry, about a quarter century. In terms of basic economic infrastructure, you're going up to a half century. When you go to some major things like total national water systems, water management systems, you're talking about a century investment. So therefore, you have to look at an economy in terms of the rate of growth of its unused up part of investment in this sort, capital investment, and you have to promote more of that, but you have to also take account of the fact that you're wearing out some of your investments, as in mass transit systems, as in power systems, as in water management systems. For example, where could you, if you were alive then and could get a drink of water from a faucet safely in where you lived, say, back 40 years ago, and how many of those locations would you dare drink water from a faucet today? And similar kinds of facilities. What happened to your health care? What happened to your ability to get health care before and now? We have used up our investment in infrastructure. We've used up our capital investment in these kinds of improvements. And since 1967-68, fiscal year 67-68, the United States has been operating on a negative rate of growth of investment and useful basic economic infrastructure. We have become poorer and poorer and poorer. Our productivity has collapsed because we counted relatively useless services, which were largely make work, to give people some kind of fake employment, to keep them busy, instead of giving them productive employment where they were producing something of physical value or some services which is of especially human value. So what we have is since 67-68, the arrival of the date of the baby boomers, when the baby boomers were rioting and becoming disgusting. From that period on, the United States economy per capita and per square kilometer has been degenerating. Now, what we've done is we've made up a lot of so-called services and other forms of employment, alternative employment, and ways of keeping people alive, which are not productive. They do not contribute to the increase of the production of physical wealth per capita and per square kilometer. So we've been investing in things we should not have invested in, and we have been failing to maintain the level of productivity in things that we do need. Therefore, look at prices. Go back and take the cost of a typical wage, weekly wage of a typical person, not some guy who flew out with a golden parachute, but a typical working person in society. Look at the purchasing power as measured in dollars and measured in physical equivalents before and now. We have been going through a long range of inflation, in this period. Why? Because we've been robbed. We've been robbed because other means, other forms of employment, other forms of activity, such as Wall Street gambling, have been used in place of investment in production. For example, the auto industry. People say that we must save the auto industry. Why do you want to save the auto industry? Where are you going? Where's anybody going these days? You're not going to work? We overbuilt the auto industry anyway. It was a fake. We shouldn't have. We should have relied more on mass transportation. For example, go back to my young years, even in the post-war period. How many hours did it take you to commute to work in a typical area in the United States? In many communities, it was 15 minutes. In other communities, a half an hour. What are people doing now? In the area of Washington, D.C., you can commute 2.5 to 3 hours from parts of this region into work within the region each way. How much of family life does that involve? That's what we're being put through this kind of process. So we have lowered the productivity, the actual physical productivity per capita and per square kilometer of the United States. And we've done similar things in Europe. We have exported our highly productive capabilities in the United States as outsourcing to other parts of the world. We have now created a really interesting problem for China. The Chinese economy is now in a phase of collapse. Because we exported, ripped up our industries from the United States and from Europe. We ripped up those industries and we shipped the production to China for us. We then go bankrupt, and China, which now depends upon these industries and this production assignment we deployed to them over the past nearly 40 years, suddenly that production, that market collapses. And China is going through a grave crisis as a result of our exporting our industries for production to China as cheap labor clauses and paying the Chinese prices which are not adequate for them to maintain the development of their economy as a whole. When it would have been more rational to give China the opportunity to develop its infrastructure and develop its industries on the basis of infrastructural development and thus have a stable situation. Compare, for example, the case of India. Both countries are countries with a lot of poor people, say 63% of the people in India. But India does not have the crisis that China has because India is dependent upon foreign exports as China is. China is highly dependent on foreign exports. And the collapse of China's export market, which is a part of a collapse of the export market of everybody these days, is now a social crisis, a political crisis for China. Russia is in the process now of collapse as a result of similar kinds of bad thinking. Europe as a whole is bankrupt, in a state of collapse. And what's the reason for it? It's largely the green thinking. We have stopped producing physical values. We have stopped capital-intensive investment. We have dropped nuclear power. And nuclear power is the essential remedy for much of the problems, economic problems we have today. If you try to go with a green policy, an anti-policy, if you go with this crazy, lunatic, free energy policy, which is the idea of a complete unscientific, anti-scientific lunatic, the planet's not going to make it. We have to go heavily to nuclear power. We need to charge up more thorium reactor plants and more uranium plants in order to meet the basic requirements, power requirements of this planet and many of the productive requirements as well. So therefore, what we have to do is we have to recognize that this crisis is not some kind of spontaneous market phenomenon or this or so forth, or what most people have said. We decided to do the wrong thing. especially from 1967, 68 on, we decided to shift away to a green perspective, away from a high technology productive perspective, an agricultural perspective. As a result of that, we lowered the productivity per capita and per square kilometer of the United States in physical terms, in terms of physical needs. We did similarly in Europe. We relied on exporting our production at cheap wages to other parts of the world. So we created the cycle. We created the collapse. This was not a market phenomenon. The market reflected the insanity of the government and many other institutions in changing the policy away from the policy we associated with Franklin Roosevelt's presidency in mobilizing for World War II into this kind of policy, the green policy, the post-industrial society policy, the globalization policy, which we have today. And therefore, we, in the process of allowing ourselves to use up the capital investment, to use up the resources for scientific and technological progress in productivity, we created the cycle. We created the pattern of using up the means we had to become as wealthy and powerful as we had been as a nation earlier. And this cycle of decay, it was already began under Truman. Truman was no asset to the United States. Truman ruined the United States, but we didn't notice it as much. It was after 67, 68, in that fiscal year, where the net infrastructural investment, physical investment in the United States went into the negative side. And similar things happened in Europe. And then after 89, worse happened worldwide. There was no business cycle. There was an insanity cycle, an insanity in terms of policies. In the post-war period, where we should have learned something from the experience of rebuilding under Roosevelt, we turned it in the other direction. And we decided there was another way to run an economy. People would like it better this way, or they would like it this way better. We didn't like to get our hands dirty anymore. And so we adopted policy where we dropped our productivity, we dropped our productive potential, and we found we've reached the point where it has run out and the system is collapsing. Now, what we have to do is invest in ourselves, invest in our commitment to a future, our commitment to change from a counterproductive mode of society to a productive mode. And that means the government must intervene and freeze these things and force investments which will, in the long term, over 25 years or so forth, will rebuild this economy to the kind of relative standard it represented a long time ago. So we are going to have to create credit, a lot of credit. And the credit's going to be partly in the form of the U.S. dollar. At the same time, we have to do something else. We have an international problem on our hands. We have, in taking steps to prompt the recovery of our system, we have to look at the rest of the world. We have to take a lead in doing that. Now, most of our problem that we have comes from the British Empire. The British Empire has been the big influence, the British influence in leading us down the pathway toward this destruction. What we have to do is we have to look now, having decided that we're going to create and solve our own system, reorganize our own system, we have to look at the same time at a partnership with other nations in rebuilding the world system on a cooperative basis. This means we have to go to say to the big nations such as China, Russia, and India. These are our natural partners. They're not the only ones. You have Korea, South Korea in particular. You have Japan. You have other countries of Asia, other countries of Europe. Europe doesn't function right now because Europe has been destroyed by this European system now operating. and Europe will have to free itself and get back to a nation-state system away from this present European common market system, the way it's developed under the British influence. The main problem we have is the British. And in anything we do generally, you have to disregard the British in making policy. Let them sit off by themselves, the British Empire, sit off by itself, let them do what it wants to. And treat them as a nation state, but don't take them into your councils in making international policy. They've already done too much of that. They've made a wreck of us. So you have to unite the United States with an anti-British coalition, in a sense, an anti-British Empire coalition. And the anti-British Empire coalition, since Europe is not ready to do that, that is Western and Central Europe, you go to Russia, you go to India, you go to China, and you then organize a world system of cooperation, bring the other nations in, and go into a long-term investment in building up the world economy. And that's the way we have to go. And this kind of decision. Now, one of the real problems here is the idea of a monetary system. No sane person should want a monetary system, but Europe has one, and we're a victim of one. What we need to do is return to a credit system. Now, remember what a credit system is in the United States. Under our policy, money cannot be uttered in the United States without the initiative of the president and without the consent of the Congress. Similarly, no international treaty can be reached except with the initiative of the president and the consent of the Congress. Therefore, our creation of what we call a credit system is that based on that consideration. So what we have to do now is put the whole system into bankruptcy reorganization, defend the dollar, and restore create an agreement with Russia, China, India, and other countries participating for a fixed exchange rate system of the type which Roosevelt specified in connection with his Bretton Woods conference in 1944. Not the 1945 procedure, which was changed from Roosevelt's under Truman. Because remember what President Roosevelt's intention was at the end of the war. Roosevelt's intention was we had a world, a broken world, a war-torn world. Russia was in a mess. Europe was ruined. England, too, was ruined. Other parts of the world were ruined. Roosevelt's intention is to eliminate the British Empire, to create a system of cooperation under a fixed exchange rate system under which the United States would take the vast productive potential which we had mobilized in the form of a military wartime capability and take that vast potential and utilize that to assist for two things. One, in eliminating empire, eliminating colonialism, freeing Africa in particular, freeing China, freeing India, rebuilding Russia, rebuilding Europe, and to use the vast machine tool and related capability we had directed for winning the war. And we did win the war. We didn't win the war because our troops were better trained than the Germans. We won the war because we had the logistics to do so, where they did not. And it was American logistics, American mass production of airplanes and everything else. Well, we had material with us when we were serving overseas. We had it in tons, where they had it in pounds. And we had that superiority in productive power to win the war. Without that American productive power, we would have lost the war. Roosevelt's intention was to take, in the post-war period, take this productive power and the policy of developing it, which he had utilized under his leadership, under wartime conditions, and say, we're now going to use that same power to rebuild the world, to provide the machine tool, capital goods, and things of that sort, which will feed the world. We're going to break up the British Empire. We're going to eliminate all empires on this planet. But under Truman, we reversed that process. Truman and Churchill, the United States with the British toll rate, the British restoring a colony in Indochina, where we, with the OSS included, had freed Indochina from colonialism. We backed the Dutch in conducting a war to reconquer Indonesia. We assisted the British in controlling India, assisted the process of splitting India between Pakistan and India, which has worked out to be quite a mess these days, and similar kinds of things. So we allowed the British to continue crimes against humanity in Africa. We in the 1970s, with Henry Kissinger and others, made it U.S. policy as well as British policy that the Africans would not increase their population, would not invest, would not have access to use of their own raw materials. Because the British and the United States of the 1970s agreed that the natural resources of Africa should be preserved for the benefit of future generations of the English-speaking people. And that goes on today. What do you think goes on today? If you want to talk about humanity, if you're not going to kick the British out of Africa, you're not serious about humanity. And we have then we have the drug problem. The British have been operating on the basis of the international drug traffic, since the 1790s. In the 1790s, the British, including some of our Wall Street types, were running the African slave trade into the United States. And then they discovered in the 1790s that this was not profitable for their ships. So what did the British do? The British went into the opium trade, and they went to India and to China and to Turkey for supplies of opium and other drugs. And they opened up the market in China for opium and opium products. And guess what? Is still running today. The Queen of England, not herself, but the institutions, runs the international drug traffic. Take the case of George Soros. George Soros is a British agent. He controls the drug trafficking, much of it, the principal part, from Asia into Europe. He controls the drug trafficking in South America. He controls it through the Caribbean. He's behind it coming in across the border into the United States from Mexico. And he's a leading political influence inside the United States. But he's a British asset. So Roosevelt understood this and understood that in order to have a safe world for humanity, which does not go into things like the two world wars that we just gone through, both of which were organized by the British, in order to avoid that, we had to kick the British out of that business. We had to eliminate all traces of imperialism and colonialism. We had to help build up these economies with our American methods of concentration of machine tool and related power to create industries, to increase the productive powers of labor on this planet. And that was our policy. Truman went the other way. So we had a process. We went into a great recession in the late 1940s because the Truman administration, in alliance with the British, went back to a pre-Roosevelt policy and in the process shut down a vast amount of the potential for production which we had built up as war material potential during World War II. That's how we went into that trouble. Then you look at the 1950s, where I began doing some consulting work then and had a chance to come up with a forecast of a 1957 recession. Well, how did I do that? Because I knew what was going on. And I looked at the way that the industries were behaving and that Arthur Burns' influence was working inside the administration of Eisenhower. And what was happening is I was able to forecast, I said, inevitably, this thing is coming down. I knew it from consulting. Take the auto industry, which is one of the industries I forecast was going to collapse, and it did in 1957, along with others. How did it collapse? Well, they decided they were trying to build up an expansion of the automobile sales and production. So what they did is they increased the lifespan of automobiles being sold. And this went from 12 months to 24 months to 36 months, and 36 months with a balloon note at the end, a big note at the end, the last payment. And this happened not only in the automobile industry, it happened in virtually every other aspect of that kind of industry. And so I simply knew the calculations. I knew that physically, the physical values for which credit was outstanding, unpaid credit was outstanding, had nothing to back them up. So I said, well, we're going to have a recession by February of 1957. We had a recession by 1957. So that there was never a case in this period where some kind of statistical forecasting, of market forecasting, explains why these things occurred, recessions and depressions occurred, as now. It occurred precisely because we, with our system, accepted policies. First of all, we accepted the shutdown of our productive potential, which was bequeathed to us as the product of the war production during the war. We shut that down in a large degree. Had a serious recession in 47, 48 as a result. We came back under Eisenhower, and we went through another credit expansion, this time under Arthur Burns' advice, which resulted in the deepest recession of the post-war period, 1957, 58. On the basis of looking at the policies then, I said, well, this system is going to collapse somehow during the second half of the 1960s, if it continues this way. And it did. In 1967, 68. And then the whole thing collapsed in 1971, 73. So I've been in the business of forecasting and the only successful forecaster of this kind of forecasting in the entire post-war period, in Europe or in the United States. Why? Because I understood these problems. And I understood that the monetarist policy is the one that leads to the kind of disaster which has hit us right now. As a result of these policies, beginning with the shift from Roosevelt's policy in 1957, the switch again, the killing of Kennedy, which cleared the way for the Indochina War, which is also used as another way of ruining the U.S. economy. In 67, 68, we had passed the zero point where the amount of infrastructure we were losing from wear and tear and other causes was greater than the amount we were gaining. So we were headed on a long-range road. Then we went to a green policy, a so-called solar policy of shutting down nuclear power, which was the one chance we had to rebuild our industries and rebuild our technology. And we became worse and worse. And under Carter, the Trilateral Commission, we destroyed the U.S. economy. We limped along with the remains of that during the 1960s. And we went into the recession under George Bush the First, or the Emperor George Bush the First, in developments in Europe. We destroyed the productive power of the world in the way we dealt with the Soviet collapse. If we had dealt rationally with the Soviet system's collapse, as I had proposed, having warned of this thing, I warned of the Soviet collapse in 1963, warned of it publicly later. The Soviet system collapsed exactly as I forecast it would collapse, and at approximately the same time I said it would collapse. We still didn't change. I forecast the 67 recession. It still didn't learn that lesson. I forecast what would happen under George Bush the First, the emperor, and they still didn't pay attention. And so it went on and on and on. So there has been no mystery to this process. There's nothing has descended from the sky upon us, unless it's from God himself. As of that as punishment for what we've done in our policy making. So what we have to do is recognize that we have made the mistakes by allowing our governments to be so stupid or so corrupt as they've been. And we're not the only stupid jerks on this planet, thank God, or whatever, the other way around. The Europeans are stupid. And what they did to Russians was criminal. The Soviet Union represented a great productive potential. Instead of cooperating with what remained of the Soviet Union after the collapse of Gorbachev and company, we should have entered into cooperative agreements with them immediately because we needed that productive power. We turned them into a basket case. Here, the Soviet Union had access to the greatest infrastructural potential in terms of raw materials in all Asia. And only in the Soviet institutions did the scientific institutions exist which are capable of developing the tundra areas and similar areas of high raw materials potential. The Soviet Union's potential, properly used, was essential for our policy for Asia. All we had to do, we didn't have to kill anybody, all we had to do is enter into, with the aid of Germany, enter in cooperation with the new government in Russia, and enter into these kinds of long-term projects, and we could have recovered nicely as a planet. We didn't. We went the opposite way. So when you're talking about the crisis today, and the economic policies and the monetary policies and the built-in policies of our government, in this way, over these years, has been the source of our self-destruction. And the time has come for us to recognize that. So therefore, we have to go back to the kind of thinking which we had under the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt. Now let me just explain one other big problem here. Some people have said that Roosevelt wasn't such a great shucks during the 1930s. Well, they're wrong. The problem has been that the British wanted to start World War I as a sort of a 7 years war repeat. The obstacle to starting that war, which the intention was to eliminate the American economic factor in Eurasia, particularly in Russia and in India and in Germany, Bismarck's Germany. Therefore, the British aim was to destroy the development, the economic development, physical economic development of Eurasia. And the two powers most relevant to that, which were tied to the U.S. policy, were Germany under Bismarck, and Bismarck's policy for Germany was an American policy. That doesn't mean it was American in the sense of being an American colony, but it meant that the model of the American economy under Franklin Roosevelt and beyond was the policy of Bismarck, especially from about 1877 on. So under Bismarck, Germany, from about 1877, 1878 on, became a great driving industrial power with a great reform in terms of labor reform. And great railway systems were being developed. Similarly, in the same period, 1877, 78, Russia moved in the same direction. They began working about developing railway systems to unite Eurasia for development. The British said, no, we won't tolerate that. So the British were out to start a war. And their intention was to get a war going between Russia and Germany over the Balkans, started by Austria. Bismarck blocked that. So what the British did is they got rid of Bismarck through the British influence on the royal family of Germany, the Hohenzollerns. As a result of that, immediately you had the assassination of the president of France with a year or two later, Sadi Carnot. You had the British, the Prince of Wales, in 1994, organized the Mikado of Japan to launch a war against China, which continued until 1945. As a result of doing these things and the assassination of a president of the United States, McKinley, and bringing in of a virtual traitor, Teddy Roosevelt, and a Ku Klux Klan fanatic, Woodrow Wilson, we joined the British side in World War I. Now, from that point on, until the election of Roosevelt, the presidency of the United States was largely controlled, presidency and Congress, both, were largely controlled by an element which we would call later, in the 1920s and 1930s, fascist. The presidency of Teddy Roosevelt, the presidency of that Ku Klux Klan fanatic, Woodrow Wilson, the man who gave rebirth to the Ku Klux Klan while he was president of the United States, and similar people from Wall Street controlled the U.S. economy and politics from 1901 until Roosevelt was elected and installed as president. Now, when Roosevelt became president, on the conditions of depression, he was able to direct the policies of the United States in an improved direction. But Wall Street was, and the Supreme Court were still controlled by the fascists. When I say fascists, I mean Wall Street bankers and other people who were actually part of this operation and who had supported Mussolini enthusiastically, who had supported Hitler enthusiastically, as Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George, the recent exit here, had supported Adolf Hitler personally. As a matter of fact, Prescott Bush, had written the letter, the equivalent of a check, to a German bank which bailed Hitler out in time to become Chancellor of Germany. And the Bush family, a bunch of fascists from that time on. Now, what happened is, on the day Pearl Harbor happened, I happened to be in New York on a Sunday that day. On the day that happened, these guys began to get a little bit scared, particularly because of Pearl Harbor, because some people knew that the attack on Pearl Harbor had been organized by the British in the 1920s. And when the British had an alliance with Japan against the United States on U.S. naval power, the British and Japanese and others were determined to cut down the U.S. naval power. And they were planned to go to the point of a warfare or a limited war with the United States in order to bring down U.S. naval power. For this purpose, Japan agreed in its part to be the agent of Britain in an attack on Pearl Harbor. So when the Pearl Harbor attack actually occurred, it had a funny effect, because what it did, it meant that the Wall Street crowd and the entire Wall Street crowd of anti-Roosevelt Wall Street crowd were entirely Hitler backers. And Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the recently exited president, who had put Hitler into power, in effect, on behalf of a British Bank of England, was among the malingerers who wasn't willing to give up his connections to the Nazis that quick. So what the problem has been is this, and these guys, these institutions, these organizations, think tanks, so forth, which were behind this process from Teddy Roosevelt's inauguration until Pearl Harbor, these people are the right-wing organizations of great influence in Wall Street and in the United States politics and finance today. And that's what the problem was in the post-war period. When Truman came in, and Truman had been a patsy of these guys, Truman changed the policies away from Roosevelt's policies back to the policies of the pre-Roosevelt period, with the backing of those New York and London bankers who had been the backers of Adolf Hitler. And what we're suffering today, and have been suffering especially since the Kennedy assassination, we have been suffering the effects of that same bunch of political influences up to the present time. Therefore, how are you going to deal with this? That means that in looking at the present crisis, the London allied crowd, the Anglo-Dutch liberal crowd from London, and their New York banker Wall Street friends and cronies, who are still the same alliance which corrupted U.S. presidential politics from the assassination of Wilson until Roosevelt's 1941 change. That crowd is still in there. Now, how do you deal with that? When you're looking at the Congress, the members of the Congress, some of them are powerful people, relatively speaking, but they're not presidents. And most of the ordinary representatives in our political system are weaklings. Some, not necessarily because they're weak morally, but because they're weak in influence and weak in power. Don't expect them, like a bunch of parliamentarians, to bail this nation out from its great troubles now. This can only come by a mobilization, a surge of mobilization of the American people, the majority, behind an incumbent new president, as it happened with Roosevelt. Now, the conditions, of course, of Roosevelt's inauguration and Obama's are different. But this principle applies. You have to take the occasion of a popular, newly elected president who comes in with a sudden authority to make changes, to make a number of very big changes, a limited number of very big changes, because all the other changes are easier to do. It's the big, crucial changes you've got to make. Don't try to sneak up on it. You're out to kill a man who's out to kill you. You've got to get him first. That means, where do you go? You go to the center of power. And the center of power here is the issue of economy. It's control of a finance, it's control over the U.S. dollar, over the U.S. credit and banking system. The President of the United States, with support of the great majority of the American people, who wish to be freed now from the afflictions they are suffering, which are worsening. A president who is in a position where the world is looking at him as a center of traditional power in the world. For what is he going to do that's going to better the conditions of life of an endangered people of China, of an endangered Russia, of many endangered nations of Asia, of the endangered people of Africa and Central and South America? What's he going to do for us, this great president? He has one limited time to act, and he's got to act on the most crucial decision. And the most crucial decision is the financial banking system. He must take charge of the financial banking system not by nice little measures, by the rough, tough measure of bankruptcy reorganization of the U.S. financial monetary system, reestablishing the kind of credit system which Franklin Roosevelt intended, and with due reference, which Alexander Hamilton had intended in founding the Department of himself, Treasury. So therefore, what you have to do, the system has been wrecked, it's been poisoned, it's been polluted, so forth. The President of the United States must move and must terrify, essentially, everybody into saying, we're going to put this financial banking system into receivership. And the best way to do it, take the Federal Reserve System specifically. It is bankrupt. Put it into receivership. Now, what are you going to do with it? Well, you're going to do two things with it. You're going to take the whole banking system. You're going to take those parts of the banking system whose functions correspond to traditional chartered banking practices. You're going to restore Glass-Steagall immediately with an amplified form. Don't take any argument on things. You're going to restore it, period. Cut it out. It was a great mistake. Cut it out. Okay? And then you're going to create a mass of credit to start some things going. Now, we don't have many industries to start going. You're not going to build the auto industry again, because we do have an auto industry. It's called Japanese. And it was a cheap labor industry, wasn't it? The old GM, Chrysler, Ford industry, that's gone. That was destroyed with the help of the leadership of the Congress in the beginning of 2006. The Congress destroyed it. They could have saved it then. They destroyed it. What are we going to do? Well, we don't need a lot of this automobile industry production. It's not going to work. It's hopeless. It's a hopeless case to start that. What you do is you take the auto industry area, and you look at two things, or three things. Look at the floor space which is associated with production for the automobile industry before. It's still there. The floor space is there. Then you take the total population associated with the auto industry of all types, ordinary people in the auto industry. Fine. Then you take third, the machine tool sector of the auto industry. Now, the machine tool sector of the auto industry is the driver. The way the thing works is science and engineering and so forth are done in the machine tool sector. Now, the work that's done by the scientific and related work in the machine tool sector now creates the designs of the products which are manufactured as automobiles or something else. This machine tool sector is a sector which produced airplanes, locomotives, and many other things in former times. It can still do that. So what we need is, as you see in the case of Katrina, you need to rebuild the water systems of the Mississippi River. We have the entire area on both sides of the Mississippi between the two mountain ranges on the east and the west, which are, in a sense, in a desperate condition. The Mississippi system is collapsing, as the case of Katrina demonstrates. The Ohio River system, which was somewhat developed, is also wrecked through old age. It needs repair, major repairs. The upper part of the Mississippi was never properly developed. All right. The Missouri side was never properly developed. We also have a vast water problem, water crisis, in the western part of the United States. Water management crisis. So therefore, one of the things that's required is the large-scale instruments required for rebuilding the water management system of the central states of the United States, between the Alleghenies and the Rocky Mountains. We also need to do this as part of developing a water system which will affect both the United States and Mexico and also benefit Canada, where we build a water management system of the type we know can be done to deal with that problem, to increase the food production, increase the food development production, and to also recruit new cities, new industries, and so forth, in parts of the countries that are now destitute. We need to go to large-scale nuclear power. Nuclear power is the only really safe and effective power needed to meet the requirements of people today, because with nuclear power you can do a lot of things, including make things clean, and you can't do it otherwise. So with the fourth generation type of uranium plant, and with the thorium cycle plant fusion, which is used largely now proposed for India for smaller applications on the border area, with this sort of thing, we can solve many problems, including problems of pollution. And these are, contrary to rumor, are perfectly safe. There is no accumulation of nuclear waste state. That's complete fraud. The story is out there, but there's no truth to it. It's a fraud. And it's a fraud of a certain faction that wanted to go in that direction. That's another subject I can go into. Right? Therefore, we need to build a mass transportation system. We can transport people by rail today at speeds of 300 miles an hour. So why do you need to sit on a highway? We can build all kinds of mass transit systems of that characteristic. We also need to decentralize a lot of our production. Instead of having very large industries controlled by certain financial centers, we need to decentralize some of the U.S. production. We need to build up centers of employment and production in various parts of the country. Go back to building the territory of the nation as a whole. So this power business, mass transit, water management, these are the tools which lead to developing the new technologies which enable us to create new industries. And that's what we need to do. So therefore, since we don't have very skilled population, there's another aspect to this which is international as well. You're not going to take a population of the farmers of India who are poor, or similar parts of the world who are poor, or the poor of Africa. You're not suddenly going to make them productive geniuses. They have a certain productive skill. Now, but what they need is something which enhances their productivity without demanding that they suddenly make a leap in capability to a production. And in Africa, for example, Africa is a big food-growing area of the world. Unfortunately, diseases and other problems interfere with the net production of food, even though Africa has a large food-growing area, agricultural area, and a population which is largely oriented to agriculture. The problem is diseases and other things destroy the food supply and prevent them from being productive. And they don't have sanitation and many other things that are necessary for this process. If you supply Africa with assistance in capital investments, with help of foreign countries, in developing transportation systems, power systems, and so forth, then suddenly an Africa which seems very destitute becomes rather productive, not because the people have suddenly their net production, which includes their general welfare. They also have natural resources there which are useful in other ways. These natural resources represent a potential source of international income for African nations if they have access to the means of developing these resources. So we can help them with that. And it's part of our job. We can do similar things in India. India has a water crisis. The water crisis is acute because many parts of the world have been depending upon what's called fossil water. We have been running down fossil water supplies, exhausting them, by not replenishing them. We are now, the fossil water resources are being drawn down. In India, for example, there's a threat to India from the using up, drawing down of fossil water resources. They got a big one in India, down deep under the Deccan, but it's 2 million-year-old fossil water and deep down. And they're being driven in that kind of direction. So that's the point. So we can, with various parts of the world, assist the world with our participation, with our policies, in moving in these kinds of directions. Recognize, as I said before, the problem here is that we have been, it's not because of this financial investment or that financial investment or this monetary thing. It's because we have adopted policies of practice in succession, especially over the post-war period, since the time that Roosevelt died. We have adopted policies which, in each case, as my own experience proves, have led predictably to a collapse of the system as it was operating then. And we have reacted again predictably to policies which led predictably to another collapse of the U.S. economy. It's not a monetary statistical thing. If you're not increasing your productivity, then attrition is taking over. If you're overestimating your income and drawing it down, you are going to have a collapse. And I can say, my authority is, I have predicted these things a number of times, forecast them, and they've always happened exactly as I've said, where everybody who uses different methods has been wrong. No one matched me on 57. It was precise. No one matched me on these other crises. They were all predictable. They were all foreseeable. Not by statistics, but by understanding the physical principles of economy. And so we come to the point now, the President of the United States must be supported in acting to put the present system, economic system of the United States in particular, into a general reform, general reorganization, reorganization in bankruptcy. This means putting the Federal Reserve System into bankruptcy under bankruptcy protection. taking the system, the assets or claimed assets of the banking system and sort them into two piles. One pile fits the chartered bank standard, conventional, ordinary banks, as under before Glass-Steagall, that kind of division. Those banks must be restored to full functioning now, and they must be used as receptacles of federal credit to get some things moving that has to be gotten moving. On the other side, the garbage side, the bailout side, not a penny. You put them into bankruptcy receivership, freeze them. That's the garbage department. You freeze the garbage so it doesn't stink too much. Don't put more garbage in there. Don't generate more garbage. And on that basis, now we can then use federal credit generated under our system, our constitutional system. With the consent of Congress, we can channel credit as needed to start some growth programs largely in basic economic infrastructure. For example, take the auto industry sector. Take that strip, which is called the auto industry in the north. Take that area, recognize, identify, earmark these areas, which are areas of machine tool capability, and have labor forces and floor space available to build things we need, such as a new national rail system, such as systems to be built, our river systems, aircraft systems, nuclear power plants, other things that are needed, mostly in the area of basic economic infrastructure. Get the people who are working in the auto plants back to work in new kinds of work suited to their traditions and skills and suited to their associations and lines of communication that they use formally for their operations. That will change things. Then at the same time, we have to do the same thing with Europe. We have to act with Europe and with Asia to help them go through a general bankruptcy reorganization of their international monetary financial systems. The first thing I would do, we're going to deal with Europe, of course. We won't have much of a problem with France. We won't have much of a problem with some people in Italy. We'll start there, if that's where we can start. China is waiting for us to come up with something to help them. They're desperate now. We have to respond. India is going to be at the point that's going to demand the same thing. Russia is in a crisis now. We have to bring in these nations, Russia, China, and India, with other nations. We have to engage Japan's cooperation, which will be no trouble under these circumstances. We have to engage Korea, which will be no trouble under these circumstances. We have to engage other nations in Asia, no trouble. We have to proceed immediately to start to turn the world in a new direction. Up. Up. And that way we can make it. So take the Federal Reserve System, have it declare from the presidency a general bankruptcy reorganization of a bankrupt system. President acts. Emergency. Under national emergency. To save the United States and to save the peace of the world. Put the Federal Reserve System into receivership. Move to create a National Bank of the United States in the Hamiltonian tradition. Use the National Bank as a way of cleaning up the Federal Reserve System and using it for the kinds of things that Roosevelt would have done were he alive today to do it. And under those conditions, we can begin to do just fine. But no more bailout. No more bailout. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Okay, as we begin the question and answer period, let me indicate a couple of things. As I think most people would suspect, I already have far more questions piled up here than I am going to have the opportunity to ask Lynn. We are going to, as we always do, prioritize the institutional questions. What I am going to try to do is, because we have so many questions from international institutions, from institutions here in Washington, and from elected officials across the United States, I have tried to pick representative questions from each group that are important and which are questions that Lynn has not had the opportunity to address. I'm also going to take a certain amount of liberty in combining questions, because in many cases we have representatives of more than one institution who have asked the same, essentially the same question. And in advance, let me say to those individuals that any errors made in representing your question is something that the errors are all mine, and I take full responsibility for them. For those of you here who have questions, you're free to indicate that you would like to ask a question. Please let me know the nature of your question and, if possible, who you represent. And we will try to get to as many of those as possible during the course of this afternoon's proceedings. I'm going to start with questions from some of the international institutions. And Lynn, we just have an enormous number of questions that have come in from Russia, undoubtedly largely in response to your recent paper. The first question is from a senior Russian economist associated with the Russian Academy of Sciences, who you know very well, Lynn. I should also mention that he is also someone who is very familiar with the U.S. framework and actually had served in a capacity here in the U.S. for many years. His question is, Lynn, many Russians don't trust the people that Obama is bringing in, for example, Hillary Clinton, not because of things that happened during her husband's presidency, but because Hillary herself has been something of a hawk in the Senate. There is also concern about Gates as a holdover from the Bush administration. Also, there are many people in Russia who believe that the United States is behind the current crisis in Ukraine and Ukraine's very hard line toward Russia. President Obama could make a major change by changing U.S. policy on putting the ABM facilities in the Czech Republic and Poland. What do you think about his doing that? Personally, I think it would be critical to addressing some of this nervousness about his new administration.
Well, I think the nervousness around the administration comes also from some other sources which are not U.S. sources or U.S. actions. For example, it's been obvious to me some time that although I announced the imminent process of collapse of the international financial monetary system in July 25th of 2007, as of November 2008, leading institutions of the Russian government and others associated with them were not up to speed, had no recognition of the fact that this international crisis existed. And my question on this has been, what are the pernicious influences which are acting on Russia to misguide a number of notable Russian officials in making the mistakes they have made in understanding the United States in this period? Now, the problem of the United States, of course, has been, as I said before, in today's remarks just previously, the United States, from the time of the assassination of the Pratt McKinley, which was an assassination intended to bring the United States on the side of Britain in a war against Germany, the United States was dominated until the election of Roosevelt by fascist elements, or elements which were identified in the 1920s, 1930s, and even 1940s as fascist, such as the Bush family. And that has been a problem. Not the failure to recognize the fact that there has been a recurring fascist element in the United States, as fascism is defined from the immediate post-World War I period. The same fascist element in our think tanks, which has been operating since Truman became president, and especially since the assassination of President Kennedy, which was a change in the situation. And don't assume that there was a lone assassin that killed President Kennedy. He may have been a moneylender, but that's the only kind of lone assassin he was. So the failure to take into account the reality of political realities of U.S. and international politics, to recognize in particular that what many people in Russia tend to blame on the United States is actually to be blamed, put at the door of the British Empire. And the softness on the British Empire is what I suspect some of the foolish things that have been said from Russian circles recently in terms of the Russian government's failure, like a suicidal act, to recognize the validity of the warning that I had given on the 25th of July, which they are aware of. And the Russians' failure to recognize the nature of the crisis even into December of 2008. I strongly suspect there's some dirty work among Russians and others coming from influences which are British or related, which have been responsible for much of this distrust of the United States. We take into account that we know that Bush is no good. Bushes are no good. We need trees, not bushes. But take that into account. That is the problem. It's been the most crucial problem. And anyone who looks at Russian history and American history should understand differently. Now, there are many people who don't know that. But I think there are other problems inside Russia, because I certainly have done everything responsible as an American to warn Russia of what I saw the threats to them were. And I don't have any problem with George Soros' problem. The Russians know very well that George Soros is no good, even though he was close with Gorbachev for a while. Gorbachev, I think, has distanced himself somewhat from them. But the biggest drug pusher in the world, the worst fascist in the world, is probably George Soros, personally. And if you have George Soros around, what do you expect? Who ran the operation in Georgia? That was George Soros and company on behalf of the British Empire. And therefore, when Russians doubt that the British Empire is their enemy, I think someone in Russia is being very foolish. And that's the problem. Hillary Clinton, that's not a real problem. That's a cheap excuse. Hillary was functioning as an ambitious political leader in the U.S. Senate. Her husband was a person who adapted to things. Not always, and I didn't always approve it, and I said so. And Bill knew it very well. Bill knew it well, and Hillary knew it well. But Hillary's behavior on this kind of thing is not really that significant. It's not the cause. That's the frictional aspect of parliamentary types of politics. And, you know, Russians should know me by now well enough to know that when in doubt about U.S. policy, what I think it means, they should ask me. I help to clear their heads a little bit. Listen to me a little bit more, and they won't make these kinds of mistakes anymore. Yeah, we have a common enemy. Russia as a nation and I have a common enemy. It's the British. And when they lose sight of that, they're in trouble. When we get them between us, you know, when I and the Russians get this British between us, we can do something about this thing. So they shouldn't break the alliance with me. That's the way to look at it. I don't think you have to worry much about this problem as such, as stated in the question. I think right now, Hillary will probably be going into Russia. I don't know what the facts of the matter are, but I would suspect very soon. I think her primary orientation will be to deal with this, probably Syria, because we're trying to salvage the very dangerous mess in Southwest Asia, with the Israelis falling into this crazy thing of this recent attack. You know, you were on the verge of an agreement with Israel. I mean, the Israelis only had to sign the papers. They had agreed to everything with Syria. If they had signed the papers instead of going into this crazy war against Gaza, forget Gaza, it's the Muslim Brotherhood, so what? Blame the Saudis if you don't like that. If they'd signed the papers with Syria, the signature on the agreement with Lebanon would have occurred. If the agreement with Israel and Syria and Lebanon had occurred, then suddenly the whole Palestinian question now becomes on the table in a positive way. Because the purpose of this negotiation is to kill Sykes-Picot. Rip up the Sykes-Picot, which the French-British alliance created as the occupation of the Southwest Asia in the period of World War I. That's where the problem comes from. You want to talk about the bloody Middle East, the bloody Arab area? Sykes-Picot, who, for example, 9/11. What about the Saudi involvement in 9/11? You think that was some loose cannon? Or was this an operation against the United States to try to change the United States politically? Was this a terrorist act intended to manipulate us, which seemed to succeed? It made a national figure out of a dummy called George W. Bush, Jr. The guy couldn't even read a goat. Think about it, my goat, you know, my pet goat. He's sitting down there. We have to grow up on this thing. The vital interest, the existential interest of Russia now at this time, in the crisis, which is a very severe one, which hit it, and for which it was caught by surprise, the Russian government was caught by surprise. Don't blame me for that. I warned it. They didn't believe me. They believed somebody else. They should get rid of that somebody else. But under these conditions, we have to get this thing going. We have to get this collaboration between the United States, among the United States, Russia, China, and India now. If we get that, if we get that collaboration, we can get control of the planetary situation. If we don't do that, I don't know if we can control it. And if we can't control it, I don't know if you want to live on this planet.
Okay. The next group of questions, Len, come from a group of professors and their students as well at the Moscow State Institute for Foreign Relations. For people who are not familiar with this, this is a university associated with the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. In November of 2008, the group held an open seminar on the global crisis, which centered on a critique of the Paulson Plan from the standpoint of Mr. LaRouche's ideas. And this seminar included the screening of excerpts from the October 1st webcast, which you can find and you can gain access to on the LaRouche PAC site. Lynn, they've submitted a significant number of questions, not all of which we're going to be able to entertain here. But there's one question in particular which is almost identical to a question that was similarly submitted by the director of the Institute for Research and Development and Security in Minsk, in Belarus. So I'll ask you the question, and I think you addressed some of it in your last answer, but I think there are other things you might wish to say. The question generally is, Mr. LaRouche, in your recent speeches, you've stressed You've often stressed the prospect for the development of human society and the solution of the common worldwide economic problems depend on the participation of the United States, Russia, China, and India. But the governments of these countries so far do not seem to have been prepared to work out a common program. My question to you is, what, in your view, is blocking this? What forces, especially in the U.S. and Russia, are hindering the process?
Well, the basic problem, the sticking point between the United States, Russia, and Russia has always been a problem involving Britain. And if you look at the Churchill, Stalin, Roosevelt encounters, and look at some of the policy issues of that time, it's always clear. The key problem has always been is that a certain element inside the United States, which is associated with that traitor Aaron Burr, who was a British agent, and actually an agent of Jeremy Bentham, who was the head of the secret committee which ran the British Foreign Office from 1982 on, or 1782 on, when the Foreign Office was founded. It was founded by Lord, but so he was part of that thing with Lord Shelburne. So the problem, always the problem has been, and if you look at Russian history, as those who specialize in Russian history do, you look from the time of Catherine the Great on, and Catherine the Great's attitude on the American Revolution, and you see that this is exactly the issue. It has always been. The Russia-U.S. issue has always been associated with the relationship or lack of relationship between Russia and the United States. And this was true also in the Soviet period. There are many problems there, but still, nonetheless, the same thing was true. And I never saw a problem in terms of my experience with U.S.-Russian relationships that did not involve a British intermediary problem. And that's the basic thing you have to address in this area. In this case, It also has to do, as I indicated in a recent paper, it has to do with the question of Marx. Now, Marx was actually a British agent. He didn't know it, but he was. Engels did know it. And so since Marxism as such, which was adopted as a kind of a Bible by the Soviets, among others, the idea was that the British system, as described by Karl Marx, was the British system. Whereas the Russian Foreign Office could always tell you on sensitive matters that the British were on the opposite side. Because when you look at the British in every part of the world, they were an imperial power. The only time they had power was when they were functioning as an empire under Shelburne, Shelburne's empire. And so Russians were often confused, and this was especially during the Soviet period, on this Marx-London connection. And the problem is that the Soviet ideologues didn't understand Karl Marx. And I think Karl Marx didn't understand himself, but that's another question. So this has been a problem. And no more than that is accepting Karl Marx, they accepted Marx's mythology, or what became known as Marxist mythology about the United States as opposed to the British Empire. The fundamental thing was the Russian doctrine was that empires were products of nation states. Now, empires were never products of nation states. An empire and a nation state are two absolutely contradictory things. Empires are supranational, such as like the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, the imperial system of chivalry under the Venetian control, the Anglo-Dutch liberal empire. It's not British in the sense. It's not the English people. The English people aren't intelligent enough to know what an empire is, at least these days. But it's actually an empire which has nations as its subsidiaries. And if you read the relevant works, the British Empire is based on a conception of Julian the Apostate, the conception of an empire which uses religion as a way of controlling people and uses conflicts among religious bodies, as you see in Southwest Asia. How do the British control Southwest Asia? You have several Jewish factions in Israel. Most of them would hate each other's guts if they didn't have to hate somebody else more. You have various Arab factions. You have the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood is a complete captive of British intelligence. It's a special faction. You have other kinds of factions among Arabs, among Islamic peoples. And the British come in there with their particular sects, and particularly now that the Saudi kingdom is part of the British Empire. It's an integral part of the British Empire. And it was, as you would find out if you look at what happened in New York in 2001, September. That was the Saudi involvement in New York. This was a favorite of George Bush. That's a fact of the matter. So therefore, you're dealing with empires which are playing, they hate nation-state authority. They use religious conflicts, artificial religious and ethnic conflicts, as ways of playing one group of people against the other. For example, the British Empire was established in February of 1763, at the time that the people in the United States, what became the United States, recognized it as the enemy, through the Peace of Paris, out of the Seven Years' War. What the British became an empire by playing, the banking circles, playing various nations of Europe in wars against each other. And when the nations had been worn down by wars against each other, organized and partly financed by the British financiers, then they had a Peace of Paris in which the British Empire, or the Empire of the British East India Company, was established. Every war run by the British is run like that. For example, World War I. The British Empire organized a war between Germany and Russia. Germany at that time was headed by the Kaiser, who was a cousin, a personal cousin, of the Tsar of Russia. And the British monarchy organized a war between Russia and Germany, like a Seven Years' War, to, again, control continental Europe. World War II was organized in the same way. The different thing in World War II was Roosevelt intervened. And Roosevelt changed the thing. Otherwise, you would have had a British support of Hitler against the Soviet Union. But when Hitler made a deal with the French fascist government, then the French fascist government allowed the German Wehrmacht to occupy a militarily inferior France. This got the British upset, because now Germany was in a position to threaten the British Empire, the British naval power. So then the British screamed for rescue from the United States. And out of that, with the Pearl Harbor event, then suddenly the United States did agree to collaborate with the British under Roosevelt, and therefore the British then, who had been the enemies of the United States in this issue, except for their fascist friends in New York, suddenly changed their policy to become anti-German. But even Churchill was pro-Hitler until that happened. And that's the way the British operate as an empire. And they do it to this day. Anybody who thinks the British are a monarchy, a kingdom, it's not. The British are an empire. Yes, they may have a queen. They have many queens, actually. But but the British Empire is essentially an Anglo-Dutch liberal Saudi empire of international financier interests which control the empire and orchestrate politics by the method of Julian the Apostate, of playing people against each other. The way Julian the Apostate, so you have this Roman pantheon, and you have the pantheon of all these little niches. Each niche is a different god and a different religion. And the Roman emperor controls all of the religions. And the same thing was done again in the Byzantine Empire. And Julian the Apostate did this. He took the idea of having the religions fight each other as his way of controlling the empire. That's what the British do. Create synthetic religions, put actual religions against each other, play ethnic issues against each other, and by getting everybody to fight everybody else, they control the fools who believe in these conflicts. And the problem, what Russia has been a victim of, is a typical British religious manipulation of, in the case of Julian the Apostate, of playing one power against another. The fundamental interests of Russia, however, lie in one area which is very important here because of the institution that sent this message. Is the problem in Russia is that in economic and related policy, historically, Russia, and especially since the Soviets, Russia has been very good in using science for taking imperfect capabilities and making them effective military capabilities, strategic capabilities. Russia at times has done similarly good work in basic economic infrastructure, as in the case of the development of the Russian railway system. But in the question of economics, production economics, Russia often stinks. Because, and the Marxist problem didn't help them any. Because the problem is that production is motivated, when it's successful, is motivated by a commitment to scientific and technological progress, to innovation based and driven by scientific and and the problem in the Russian system, especially in the Soviet system, as the Soviet literature would advise you, the Russians stunk in terms of manufacturing. See, when they're motivated by military considerations, they muster scientific capabilities, even contrary to their Marxist instincts or whatever. When they're motivated by a strategic project, which is not necessarily military, but strategic, which is infrastructure, they have achieved great things. When it comes to running a factory or a farm, the performance stinks. And this is the area in which the traditional German or traditional American approach to industry was superior to the Russian approach in these areas. And there's a lack of real understanding, still to this day, in the Russian system on one thing, and it's not limited to a Russian problem, is that it involves the nature of man and involves a peculiar kind of religious problem about the nature of man. That man is not an animal. And the Marxist theory tends to be that of man as an animal. Man is inherently creative, as no animal is. We make fundamental discoveries of universal physical principle. And those discoveries we then, hopefully, apply to improve the way we behave, to make discoveries of principle which we apply to nature in order to increase man's power over the universe per capita. No animal species can do that, only mankind. The tradition has been, under empires, is to deny this. You, for example, have the famous Prometheus issue. Prometheus says man is not allowed to discover the principle of fire and to use it. The principle of fire is the creative power of discovering a universal physical principle. The way that many empires have prospered is by controlling societies, by prohibiting them from making changes in science and technology practice, just like the greenies of today. The greenies are the same thing. They say progress is bad. Concentration of power through scientific progress is bad. We must go back to old ways, old primitive peasant ways. And that's what the problem is. And so, therefore, the fact that the official science, as taught in U.S. universities today, or as taught in much of Russian tradition, does not recognize the role of the discovery of a universal physical principle as the proper basis for science and for economy is the major problem. And what I propose is simply is that, as it, the Russians have a very great capability, inherently, historically, in developing resources which are crucial for Asia. For example, in the northern tundra area, there are mineral resources which are essential for the future of all Asia. Russia is peculiarly capable of addressing that kind of problem and coming up with solutions. And that is typical of the kind of cooperation we need with Russia. The other side of Russia is a Eurasian economy, not a European economy or nor an Asian country. It goes with the history of Russia, which is both Europe and Asia in terms of its development, especially since Genghis Khan. So this means that Russia in Asia is a link between European civilization and Asian civilization in a very meaningful sense in respect to Asia itself, in terms of the nations of Asia. The development of the undeveloped region of Siberia is typical of this. And you find the typical relations between India and Russia in many areas are also typical of this. So therefore, Russia's importance is for us is what it is on one thing. On the other hand, the United States needs now to deal beyond Europe with the question of the development of Asia. And therefore, Russia is for us an ideal Eurasian partner for us in promoting the development of Asia. Thank you.
No. Lynn, the next question is from the, again, from the director of the Institute for Research and on Development and Security in Minsk, Belarus. Says, Mr. LaRouche, many people right now have great hopes for the new U.S. President Barack Obama, who has taken office. After the deafening foreign policy failure of the Bush administration, people link the arrival of the new president with very big changes, both inside the United States and throughout the world. However, a number of experts say openly that the new president is far from being independent and that he was installed in this post by world elites to serve as a scapegoat. The scale and depth of this crisis is too great, and there is so far little basis to hope that this young president will take extraordinary steps. Moreover, despite being an active person, until now he has remained silent about many important issues, including the events in Gaza. On top of everything else, it has been observed that there is a standoff inside the United States between the globalists on the one side and the Siloviki, government, military, and intelligence-oriented people like Gates and others, on the other side, and that the latter began to lean on Obama even before he took office. I am referring specifically to the publication of a poll taken among military people in an American military journal where most of the officer corps was negative toward the president. Do you agree that in Obama's case, the court will make the king? And that in a critical situation, all the failures will be blamed on him. What role do you think Obama himself will play in the future of the U.S.?
If you look more carefully at the things, a lot of the stuff you cited you would pass over, because that is the frictional kind of considerations which are, including the reference to Gates. It's a complete misunderstanding of Gates. Gates was put in order to try to prevent a war with Iran, among other things. There, many of us screamed about this danger, and Gates was accepted and took a position at that, and he's resolved, apparently, to continue to occupy that office in order to maintain the continuity of that function. He is a man of his own opinion. I don't endorse necessarily everything he thinks, but he is a responsible person, and he has function responsibility, and he was a very important tempering feature inside the Bush administration at the time. The Bush administration was becoming very dangerous in terms of the Middle East. As you have to recognize that Cheney, who was a British agent, and people in Eastern Europe don't get this point about British, and they make most of the mistakes I hear from them are on the failure to recognize the British problem. That's the threat. If you want to save civilization, get rid of the British factor. If you don't want to get rid of the British factor, if you're worried about the American factor, you don't have much. You're not going to get anywhere. You won't like the result of your own opinion. Now, but Gates is not the problem. Gates did a useful job. I was aware of this. I watched this all the way through. And my estimation, Gates did an honest job. He did the mission for which he was put in, and that is to counter people like Cheney, who is a British agent, who was using everything possible to get us into a war with Iran. And he did that job. But he did it as a professional inside the U.S. institutions, according to the rules of game inside the U.S. institutions. If he had not played the game as you play the game inside the U.S. institutions, he would have failed. And he was experienced at that job and knew how to do it and did it well. So that's not a problem. What you have to look at is, where is the problem coming from? Don't look for signs, strange signs, or satanic signs or symbols, or Freemasonic symbols. Look at the way institutions perform. What is the policy of the United States? If the policy of the United States is to save the United States, if it's our traditional policy, a policy that the American people would put up with in terms of their own interest, then you and how do and the way U.S. institutions behave, then the U.S. interest lies in a secure relationship with most parts of the world, including Russia, including China, including Japan, including nations of South America. Yes, there are conflicts, but we're talking about basic interests. The United States' interest is not in this kind of penny-ante games. It's not in this witchcraft. The United States is a serious institution, especially now with this president. And don't misunderstand this president. Because the president of the United States is not some flunky stuck in there. We've had a flunky stuck in there, George W. Bush. And I think, I think Putin did not make a mistake in trying to deal with Bush, because Bush was a member of a major, representative of a major team. But I think there was a lot of mythology about this thing. But the point here is that the U.S. institution, the presidency, is not to be compared with a parliamentary head of government. Parliamentary head of government is a foolish institution. Sometimes they do good things, but they are not a very good institution. They're a relic of feudalism. No? U.S. government, the U.S. institution, is a presidential system, not a parliamentary system. No? The presidency of the United States is not an individual. The presidency of the United States is the part of a presidency, which includes many people and many institutions. The Congress is a subsidiary but essential institution in this process. Ours is a presidential system. When we have a bad president, we're in trouble. And even people in the good presidential institutions who are decent people have trouble functioning under a bad president or a bad presidential circle. But they try to stay on ship and function and hope for a better president. But the policies, Obama's coming in, and coming in the way he did, was a decision made by the presidential system. Look at the people he brought on. Hillary Clinton. Look at the rest of the people he brought on, the key people. Yeah, you got a few dummies in there, but who did he bring on? He composed around himself the apparatus of a presidency, a U.S. presidency. And he represents a U.S. presidency. He's not a stooge. And don't make that mistake. The fate of Belarus and Russia now depends upon achieving a positive relationship between the United States and Belarus and Russia. That's the way to look at it. Any other policy is fatal folly.
Okay, I'm going to entertain one more international question, and then I'm going to move to a series of questions from U.S. institutions. Before I do that, let me just mention that some people are growing very impatient because they have questions and they're sending me hate mail. Save your ink. I will try to entertain all questions before we're done, but to the degree that we don't get to them, I will, as I always do, forward those questions to Mr. LaRouche. And that includes the gentleman who claims that he's a direct descendant of Hegel and Genghis Khan. I'm serious. And I should tell him that he would have had a better chance of me asking his question if he didn't tell me that, because he scared me. The next question, and the last international question for this segment, comes from His Excellency Syed Hassani, who is the former ambassador from Pakistan. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, being a statesman of vision, you have the unique ability to present ideas in a historical perspective. My question to you relates to the advice you would give President Obama about the dangers of getting involved further in Afghanistan. He began his presidency with moves to implement the withdrawal from Iraq, but there is some fear that he will next move to relocate 40,000 men to Afghanistan in an effort to deal with the threat of terrorism and al-Qaeda. The NATO commander is reported to have said that a military solution in this region would not work, advising the president instead to resort to negotiations with the Taliban, currently being attempted by President Karzai. Besides this, the hot pursuit of Osama bin Laden may very well involve a violation of Pakistan's territorial sovereignty, engulfing Pakistan in war. Given this scenario, would it not be wiser to solve the Afghan imbroglio diplomatically through the traditional tribal yerga system, which is local convention, instead of attempting a military solution that could result in a second Vietnam?
Well, I am sympathetic to the question in some respects, but I don't think it implies a solution. I don't think that the United States troops should be involved at all in Afghanistan at this time. That I agree with. It's foolish. You have to look at what the problem is. The problem is when a farmer in that region of Afghanistan or neighboring regions harvests a crop of opium, the crop may be priced at some hundreds of dollars, $600, $700. When that crop reaches Europe, its price is $6 million, or the United States, similarly, $6 million. Now, the problem is, then, you go to a very specific gentleman you want to talk about, George Soros. George Soros, remember who he is. At the age of 17, he was a young Jewish boy, from Carrion Providence, who saved his life by adopting a non-Jewish identity and doing work for the Nazis on the Jewish question. He was an instrument in what then what Hecht described as perfidy. This was a deal which the Nazis proposed that for so many trucks given to the Nazi system from the British Americans, that so many Jews would live. And if the trucks didn't come, they would kill that number of Jews. And they assemble Jews or people who were not necessarily Jewish by their own inclination, but who had Jewish ancestry. You know, one-fourth Jewish, partly Jewish, so forth, from all parts of the Balkan region. And they herded them up, put them in camps, stripped them of their wealth, so forth, the whole procedure. And he was the messenger boy who would send the message, hey, here's your ticket for the train. And he did this. He's a part of perfidy. Now, he doesn't do that today exactly. But that's his character. And because of this character, he adopted this kind of character. You know, a person who would do that is a degenerate. I don't care how they became a degenerate, they're a degenerate. He defends it. He defended it publicly, repeatedly in recent years, in public broadcasts, and said it was an experience that did him good. Yes, and what does he do now? He's done many things. He's a British agent, works through the British Foreign Office, the Commonwealth Office, with Lord Malleck-Brown. He's the biggest dope runner in the world. He runs the drug traffic out of Asia into Europe. He runs most of the drug traffic in Europe. He runs most of the drug traffic in South America. He runs the drug traffic from South America into the United States. Notably, from Mexico into the United States. Now, look at this problem. Is this problem of terrorism in Afghanistan a Saudi problem? Yes. Did the Saudis create it? Yes. How was it created by the Saudis? By the Wahhabi cult. When they used that to train people as fighters in Afghanistan against the Soviets. So out of that, all through the Arab world, this Wahhabi cult, run by the Saudi kingdom, which is a British agent, created this group of new formed terrorists, Arab terrorists, including Osama bin Laden, including the Taliban organization, and created and used these and involved them in the drug traffic directly or indirectly. These forces are now being used. A section of them runs out of London under the protection of the Church of England, which took some of these terrorist agents of Arab origin. That does not suggest that the Arabs in London are terrorists. Some are, but most aren't. Most of them are just normal Arabs, or Muslim believers in London. So what? It's not a problem. But some of these guys are actually terrorists. And how are they able to function? Because the Church of England declares them under protection as clergymen. Diplomatic protection as clergymen. So this organization in London is the organization which is part of, under British intelligence, through MI6 and formerly through the ISI in Pakistan, which ran the Mumbai terrorist operation recently in the South. And this organization is prepared to run terrorist operations in every part of the world. It's the most mobile, repeatable terrorist operation we have on hand. Now, the same thing applies to our border. Why is our American weapons going across the border by these funny little wagons, desert wagons, running in there, delivering weapons to the drug traffickers, including military-grade weapons to the drug traffickers in northern Mexico? And why are the drugs coming from northern Mexico or from various parts of South America through northern Mexico across the U.S. border? Why are the guards turning the other way and looking the other way when the drug shipments are coming across or when the weapon shipments are going down? And this is now a major terrorist threat to the United States. The problem here is the failure to take perfectly accessible modes of action to neutralize the transport of these goods, drugs and weapons. Putting troops into Afghanistan to protect the area or the Taliban area is simply creating more targets. Why do you want to send more targets of the drug terrorists into Afghanistan? Pull them out. You may want to protect Karzai and the capital in order to maintain some integrity of that territory, but you don't want to put troops in there. That's not the cure. That's a diversion. What you want to do is shut down George Soros and shut down everything like him. And if you don't do to shut down George Soros, you're not serious. So what we're doing is when you do play that kind of behavior, what you're doing is you're saying, let's play a game. We pretend we're chasing you, and you pretend you're chasing us. And we'll play the game. And we'll send some soldiers out to get killed in the crossfire. No. No U.S. troops put into Afghanistan except to ensure the security of the city, the capital city. Dry it out. No drugs leave Afghanistan. No drugs leave that area. Enforce it. And take sanctions against any nation that doesn't enforce it. Why get U.S. soldiers killed? We've lost too many already. We don't need to.
Okay, I'm now going to move to a selection of questions from institutions based here in Washington who are tied to the new administration. Lynn, the next question comes from a section of the Economic Advisory Group. And they say, Mr. LaRouche, we represent a multidisciplinary group centered at Stanford, Berkeley, and Princeton, who since early November have been tasked with working on your triple curve function as a model for economic analysis. Little argument can be made right now as to its accuracy in defining our current predicament. However, it's my understanding that you developed this model long before financial instruments like derivatives ever even existed. This may be too involved a question for you to address in this venue, but if you can, would you please indicate to us how you were able to forecast this dynamic before the instruments which arguably caused this current crisis were even born?
Well, I was a smart kid. But essentially, no, I understood economics. That's why my discoveries in economics were, well, of course, part of a childhood experience in a sense. My father was a consultant in the footwear industry and a few other things. And I was never dumb. I got into a lot of trouble for that reason. But but in 1953, I, in a sense, completed a phase of, shall we call it, my education. And by that time, I had adopted understood that we cannot possibly deal with or understand economic processes except as looking at them, first of all, as physical economic processes rather than monetary or financial processes. And secondly, that we could not do this unless we abandoned the usual Cartesian-type methods of thinking about economy, even physical economy, which are prevalent in most universities today. That you had to use, you had to apply the concept of dynamics as reintroduced to modern civilization in the 1690s by Gottfried Leibniz, and then the concept advanced competence dynamics by Bernard Riemann. And Riemann's conception as exemplified by his famous habilitation dissertation of 1854 is the key to understanding all their competent understanding today of any physical kind of physical process. And economic processes as physical processes can be only understood as Riemannian systems. Now, in Riemannian system, the variable you're looking at, as in dynamics, and you could go back to the Dynamicum of Leibniz in 1695, Specimen Dynamicum, for the definition of this. The point was is that the reductionists in physical science and so forth are idiots, and they should not be allowed to. They can repair things, but they should not try to design anything. I mean, it's allowed, but not design. Because the difference between man and a beast is that no beast is capable of creating the discovery of a valid universal physical principle. Only an individual human mind can do that. This, of course, is the reason implicitly why academician Vanadsky emphasized the question of the noosphere as distinct from the biosphere. That human beings are not, or human beings originally essentially spiritual, you would call them, because what happens in the human body is a biological entity, apparently, but it has a function it performs intellectually which is not biological. And this function is called creativity, and it's most easily identified, that is from a scientific experimental standpoint, by the discovery of a universal physical principle. It also has a complementary way of being defined in terms of artistic composition. But the most common approach is to physical principles. Now, in physical principle, as in the case of the Leibniz differential, as opposed to all the other versions of things, the calculus, is that this concept of Leibniz comes essentially from the discovery of gravitation by Johannes Kepler. And what Kepler did was to discover the differential, the infinitesimal, in terms of the characteristic of the planetary orbit, such as the orbit of Earth, that there's no way by quadrature of the ellipse or quadrature of the circle that you can define the meaning of the infinitesimal in the curvature of the planetary orbit. Now, this was then treated again by Kepler in what is called the harmonies of the world. And in book four of the harmonies of the world, he takes the thing up in a very specific way, which was later addressed by Albert Einstein. And that is that the harmonics of the organization of the solar system are such that you cannot explain this from a visual standpoint or from a simple oral system. That is, not from the sense of sight, the use of the function of the concept of the section of sight to portray the orbital pathway, or from the function of sound, simple sound, to define the orbital pathway. But rather you have to rely upon something from music called harmonics. And you realize then, when you do this, as that you are dealing with something, a phenomenon, in which neither the sense of sight nor hearing defines the phenomenon you're looking at, the phenomenon of change which you're looking at, which defines the orbital system of the planetary system. So Leibniz, in this sense, in the 1690s, returned to this conception, because he was a student of the work of Kepler. All competent modern science comes from the work of Johannes Kepler on physical science. Anything else is, forget it. So he recognized that the infinitesimal of the calculus, which he had been originally discovered, based on this appreciation of this work of Kepler, involved an ancient conception from which is called the infinitesimal. Was called No. What do you call the infinitesimal? But this of dynamics. And therefore, we understand that the creativity is always expressed, creative in terms of physical principle, is always expressed in terms of this kind of dynamics, of the infinitesimal, which has no finite quality, but is simply the appearance of a principle as a discontinuity in a system of action. Right. So therefore, what the difference between man and the animal is that mankind, by discovery of new physical principles and applying these to production, is able to transform man's power to generate physical values, to increase man's power to produce something, that sort of thing. And so therefore, this kind of concept is the basis for all competent science, all competent economy. All present economists, as taught in universities, do not know this. And therefore, they try to figure out from a financial system, the idea of profit in terms of a financial system, or marginal income in terms of a financial system, not in terms of a physical system. And what in all progress of science is based on that. For example, let's take the case of simple stupidity among today's typical environmentalist. If you measure power in calories, you're an idiot. If you think that a calorie of sunlight is equivalent to a calorie of nuclear power, you're an idiot. Because a calorie of nuclear power is thousands of times more powerful than a calorie of sunlight. Sunlight is very useful when it comes in the form of solar radiation in terms of chlorophyll. Extremely useful. Then the sunlight increases its work. The power increases its work on behalf of man, or on behalf of nature, in many ways. Whereas if you simply use it as power, what do? If you use up all the sunlight, you make a desert. If you take the sunlight and apply it to plant life, you make prosperity. So sunlight, in a sense, as a living principle of solar, the chlorophyll is a living principle, actually increases man's power in and over the universe. Whereas the same number of calories consumed as solar power for a solar reactor is a waste of time. What is it? If you have enough solar plectrums, what do you get? You got a desert. You have enough calories, you get enough chlorophyll, you get a forest. That's the difference. And you get human life and that and all kinds of things. All right. So therefore, it is human creativity, individual creativity of the individual human mind, such as physical discoveries, universal physical discoveries, the application of these to the productive process in particular, is the means by which man is able to increase his power to exist on this planet. So what you have is you have financial systems. All these financial systems of economy, they're not worth anything because they don't take into account the most important thing, how you increase the productive power of labor per square kilometer and per capita in a world in which the key opposing factor is depletion. If you simply try to do the same thing over and over again and expand the population on that basis, you're going to run down the planet. If, on the other hand, you take and use creative methods, which involve this concept, which Leibniz defined as the differential, the infinitesimal, and you apply this as in the case of chlorophyll, or in the case of nuclear power, which is thousands of times more efficient than the same amount of calories expressed in the form of sunlight on binging on the Earth. So it's this characteristic. So what happens is you find in the history of mankind that all backward societies, including especially societies of slavery, prohibit the slave from developing discoveries of principle. The slave is told to follow in the footsteps of his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather and not to try to change the way in which he produces. Now, the effect of this is in all societies which are fixed-mode societies, lead to the destruction of the society by itself simply by continuing to exist. All societies which are successful take natural resources and increase the power of natural resources by these kinds of methods called discoveries, which reflects the same kind of principle that Kepler recognized in the organization of the solar system, or that Einstein and others recognized in terms of the way the world is organized. So the problem with economists generally is they don't look at this factor of creativity. They call all kinds of creativity, including the ability to masturbate in new ways. But that's not creativity. It's the discovery and use of newly discovered principles which increase man's power in and over the universe, and the organization of these discoveries in the form of production or other relevant ways to increase the power of man to exist and to exist in a better way. So, therefore, economy is not to be studied, first of all, as financial economy or monetary economy, but to be examined as a physical process, a physical scientific process, with attention to things like life, as in the case of Vernadsky's work on life and on the idea of the noosphere. So you're looking for the principle of change, which distinguishes, on the one hand, living processes from non-living ones, and human processes which are distinguished advantageously from non-human living processes. And this is expressed by invention, by production, and also by the development of an appropriately improved infrastructure, such as an increase of nuclear power. And the greater the nuclear power, in terms of per square centimeter power, the greater your productivity. So therefore, if I go into in India and I find an Indian farmer who is what he is in his skill, and I bring in the factor of nuclear power in the form of enhanced water resources, freshwater resources, which you can only make efficiently from nuclear reactors, as with, say, the thorium cycle reactor, which is appropriate for the coast of India, then you have increased the productive power of labor of that farmer without changing the way he produces, because you have changed the conditions under which he produces and therefore increased his productivity. So all economy is based on that. The problem we have, for example, is under the former director of the our monetary system, our Federal Reserve system, who was an idiot. And his idiocy has dominated the interpretation of what productivity is in the United States today. Forget Greenspan. Get rid of him. He's gone. Get rid of what he did. Therefore, we have to have a system which is which functions not on the basis of counting dollars or counting marbles, by counting the increase of the level of productivity per capita and per square kilometer of the United States and of other countries. This means investment, capital-intensive investment, in technologies and in modes of production which multiply the effective productivity of the working individual or the producing individual. And therefore, if you want an economy which is going to grow, you have to have a capital-intensive investment, because to build a nuclear power plant costs a bit of money. It wears out over, say, 40 or 50 years if you maintain it properly. So you have a 40-year investment. It's a capital investment. And the importance of the capital investment is not the size of the investment in money. The importance of the capital investment is the amount of increased yield per moment of action that you get as a result of that power at that intensity. It's just simply a matter of physical science. You raise the level of energy flux density of any process, you increase the potential productivity of that process. And you just simply have to know enough science, enough physical science and other things to know how to make that work. That simple. So therefore, what we need is capital-intensive, long-term investments, concentrating first of all on the basic economic infrastructure. First of all, water, power, mass transportation, and so forth. make these more efficient. Therefore, even simple labor will be increased in its productivity because you have created the environmental preconditions for enhancing the effective productive power of that act of production. And that's the point. The problem is that this has left. So it was, for me, it was simple to forecast. My forecast cycles always worked on this way. So the condition I was forecasting about was different. You know, the auto industry forecasts I did back in the 1950s, which was unique, but it was very simple for me. I was simply doing consulting in this area. I knew a number of these whole auto industries, knew how the thing was rigged. And I said, along with other industries which are doing something similar, I said, this is finished. It's gone. When I find that somebody has a vehicle which has a 24-month life, useful life, and is sold on the basis of 36 months with a giant balloon note in the 36th month, and I find that not only the auto industry is being run that way, but many other industries are run that way, I can look at the capital factors and tell you at the point this is going to blow out. It's that simple. And it's that kind of consideration, to give a simple illustration, which I used. It's always the same. We kept coming back to one condition under Truman. We got to another condition, which is the Vietnam War condition, under the Vietnam War conditions, that we were destroying the economy. And we were going to destroy the economy once the policy of Wall Street and London was introduced, the policy against which Kennedy fought in the steel negotiation issue. Once Kennedy's policy was eliminated, the United States was going to go the way these guys were going to send him. And it went that way. By 1968, it was going that way. In 1961, they blew it. The same thing happened in 1970s. They blew it again. The Trilateral Commission did the greatest amount of destruction to the United States economy in terms of rate of any time in its modern history. Until we got to George Bush the First, the Emperor George the First. And he did a good job. And then you had the effect of the Green Revolution in effect, the anti-industrial, the anti-nuclear, all this kind of thing. And again, what we were counting upon as production was fake. The ratio between the cost of production to the U.S. population as a whole and the benefits of production was such, we were losing. And what happened then is Greenspan came in, and Greenspan said, this doesn't work. This is after the crash, the October 1987 crash. It didn't work. I forecast that one. And what he did is he went to financial derivatives of self-inflating fake money. And the world economy now is sitting under the weight of $1.4 quadrillion dollars of absolutely fake money. And under the present conditions, that fake money is growing like a cancer. While the world economy, in terms of employment and production and goods produced, is shrinking. So therefore, what you have to do is you have to take the cancer and excise it. The entire financial derivatives bubble created by Alan Greenspan has to be taken out in the backyard and shot. And then buried. That's the solution. So there was nothing mysterious about this, because you think about how these curves function. It simply was, to me, I had a Vatican conference I attended where it happened, the curve itself, and it was on healthcare. So I submitted a report to the Vatican on my participation in that conference. And then later, the following months, I was running for president, so I just published this triple curve on that basis. All that was the description of what I know, the way the system is working, and the way the system has worked ever since I first got into the business back in 1953 as a successful student of the work of Bernhard Riemann on the principle of creativity.
My boss deserves more of a bigger hand of applause for that answer. Then the next question is similarly from the Economic Advisory Group. It's a simpler question. They say, Mr. LaRouche, whenever a discussion of the Federal Reserve takes place, there's a very vocal group that asserts that the Federal Reserve is unconstitutional, blah, 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 blah. We do not wish to address that question. However, former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker and Treasury Secretary Designee, who I think now may be Treasury Secretary, Geithner, have indicated that the current manner in which the Fed has been operating is way outside its charter. With that said, what, in your mind, is actually the proper role of the Federal Reserve in this current situation?
It's to be gobbled up and eaten by a higher species. That higher species should be a national bank. All right, first of all, the Federal Reserve System is bankrupt. I think no sane person who's familiar with the facts would disagree with that. So therefore, what we have to do is the President of the United States has to himself, in a sense, probably give an executive order, saying to the effect that his finding is that the system is bankrupt. And therefore, it must be placed now in receivership. That it will continue to function under federal supervision of the executive branch. In other words, assimilate the authority, take away the independence of the Fed, of all semblance of the independence of the Fed, and by putting into bankruptcy, assimilate it into the authority of the executive branch directly, as a part of the executive branch and an agency of the executive branch. Now, we want to move that around. So the way the executive gets rid of it is by going to the method proposed by Alexander Hamilton, create a national bank and have the national. What you want to do is this. First of all, go back to this chartered bank system. We want only essentially chartered banks involved with deposits, which involve firms and regular borrowers and lenders. We want to secure, above all, the public, the saver, and the person who's depositing as a manufacturing firm or something else who's depositing their proceeds in this thing, they have to have protection. The individual saver has to have protection. So the federal government must protect them, or the state government must protect them with federal backing. So fine, we want to separate them. We'll take all this other stuff, and we call it trash. They call it bad bank. I call it big bunk. Take all this trash and don't pay a nickel for it. Just put it as in the waste deposit for further disposition. But in the meantime, what you must do is free the essential part of the economy to continue functioning, including the essential banking function. Now, what I had proposed back in July 25th, back in 2007, was to put the Homeowners and Protection Act in place, and that would have meant that we would have protected the chartered banking system entirely from the effect of this, and we wouldn't have this problem. What happened is that Barney Frank of Barnum and Bailey engaged in a swindle which he was instructed to carry out to prevent, as ordered by Pelosi, to prevent protection from being given to the chartered banks. In other words, Mrs. Pelosi was acting as a swindler in preventing harm to the vital interests of this nation and its people by taking away the protection which their regular banks, chartered banks, require, and opening the gates for the swindlers of the world to come in and steal and steal and steal and steal. This is not, the United States government is not Las Vegas. and should not be Las Vegas. So that's where the problem came in, that we didn't do that. So now we have to reverse the effect of what Barney and Bailey Frankout did. We have to take and separate that we take, because the chartered banks have been cluttered up with this filth, this garbage. Carry out the garbage. To go into the bank and say, this is fits the quality of a chartered bank account. Protection. This does not. No protection. You go without a condom. And then you've got to clean this mess up. But don't go with these other halfway measures. You have to take a ruthless attitude. The American citizen has to have a clear understanding. The American citizen needs presidential action. When the president has to act, the citizen has to understand clearly what the president is doing and why he's doing it. No mishmash. Come straight to the point. This is theft. We don't allow you to be thievery to invade your pantry. We're taking this useless garbage, we're putting it over here. That's the garbage pail. Don't call it a bad bank, call it a garbage pail. This is something in the bank which qualifies as a chartered banking account. This is protected. So essentially you use bankruptcy proceeding by putting the system through bankruptcy, the Federal Reserve System through bankruptcy. You sort out the garbage from the valid account. The valid stuff must go forward as if nothing had happened, just as it was supposed to go normally. Now the federal government can now come up with money for bailout, but not for this garbage. Money in order to promote the recovery of production and employment, both foreign and domestic. And the garbage will simply, and what we have to do is create a system of national banking through which private chartered banks of the United States on the federal or state level are able to have a vehicle under the protection of the federal government in dealing with domestic and foreign accounts in the way that Alexander Hamilton prescribed. And do this in memory of the great 1837 panic, which was caused by Andrew Jackson in overturning the National Bank.
Lynn, the next question comes from the chief of staff of one of the Senate offices, who is tasked with dealing with questions around the TARP funds. He says, Mr. LaRouche, as you know, former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, speaking on behalf of a group that includes Secretary Treasury Geithner, Larry Summers, and a host of others who now have official positions in the Obama administration, issued a strong recommendation for a return to the Glass-Steagall framework along with other strong regulatory measures. But Mr. Volcker also indicated that for these measures to work, other issues would have to be addressed first, specifically the fact that in the absence of regulatory control, the banking system is drowning in toxic paper, and all U.S. banks are essentially bankrupt. Now, he addresses two questions here. I'm just going to go through it very quickly. He says, yesterday, Geithner made two tentative proposals to the Senate. One was to take all of the toxic paper and to place it in one place. This is not the bad bank proposal. He said that in public health terms, it would essentially be placed in quarantine so that we could begin to work with what is otherwise salvageable. I think Lynn answered this. But number two, he says Geithner also indicated that the administration's view is that they want the second half of the TARP funds to be released and to be used not to bail out the banks per se, but that the banks would function essentially as clearing centers for the disbursement of funds directly to the people who are hardest hit by the credit crunch, namely homeowners, small businessmen, farmers, and others, whose access to credit has been largely cut off in the midst of the current crisis. This would clearly serve as a major injection of relief delivered directly to those Americans being strangled by the cutoff of credit. Although I understand these measures fall short of what you've proposed, they've already provoked howls of protest from the world's financial capitals. That's true. They called Geithner the Antichrist yesterday. Our view is, however, that such measures could be taken almost immediately and that they would go a very long way to providing the new administration with a kind of support and goodwill from the majority of Americans that would then allow the administration to move forward with what are deeper and probably more controversial restructuring measures. Could you please comment on this?
Well, you have to remember that back in 2007, I proposed all the remedies that are required. And what I proposed then is better than what's being proposed now. The Homeowners and Bankers Protection Act, which secured a tremendous amount of support on the state and local levels in the United States, still provides for this. You don't need to mix this thing up. You provide the Homeowners Protection Act because that's a very separate question, including question of whether fraud was committed in creating some of these mortgages, or whether they were overpriced, or whether they should be reduced, and so forth, in what form for the homeowners. Because remember, a lot of these mortgages were swindles. And today, the value of the property, which is mortgaged, is vastly below the mortgage. So therefore, separate the homeowner question, mortgages, from the other questions. This is a product, if you don't like that, blame Alan Greenspan. He created the mess. All right, then go to the bankers as a separate issue. In other words, you provide protection for the banks and the homeowners on one side that against foreclosure action. And on the other side, you then protect the banks to be able to continue to issue and utter loans. And instead of having the money dispersed like a pass out, one-time pass out, it's all right to have a level of what you intend to bail out. But I would put it two ways. I would take, first of all, enact the Homeowners and Bankers Protection Act, simply. Then go to the fact that that act was proposed at a time before the crime had been committed. And the crime was committed with the Barney and bailout thing. So then go to the bank question. What we want to do is, on the turn of a dime, is have on one day, the garbage is now declared out of the system. It's in a depository which is not going to be argued anymore. We're going to take what is valid in the banking system, that is, which corresponds to a chartered bank, and go straight forward to this thing. Don't go with this mishmash, maybe this and that, so straight. You had a bank, which under the previous administration, and there is a question as to whether there was something criminal or tantamount to criminal in the way the Bush administration handled this thing in 2007, 2008. Did the Bush administration commit crimes? Are you going to get in and compound this mess of crime before the question of whether a crime is committed or not is settled? Maybe the president committed a crime, committed a fraud against the people. Maybe his officials assisted in a fraud against the people, against the United States. I think they did. I think after a Pecoris-type investigation, the American people would think so. So let's get the Pecora Commission process started. Let's settle the thing and put this thing in one compartment. if it qualifies as what had been a chartered bank consideration under Glass-Steagall, then it goes in one category and the bank goes back and starts functioning right again in that department as before. Credit can be supplied by the federal government to these banks through not the Federal Reserve System right now, because the Federal Reserve System is not trustworthy. It's also bankrupt. Therefore, we have to go through a facility by putting the Federal Reserve in bankruptcy. If you don't put it in bankruptcy, how are you going to do it? And then you have to think of where you're going to move this whole operation. You're going to move to what Hamilton conceived as national banking. And you're going to take Andy Jackson and say, Andy Jackson, you may be a good Democrat, but you're a lousy American. Because what you did in repealing the Hamilton's design was to set us up for the 1837 panic. And you, in a sense, are setting us up for something like the 1837 panic all over again, which almost destroyed the entire financial banking system of the United States. So I think go the other way. Put the Federal Reserve System into bankruptcy. It is bankrupt. Separate what we used to be considered as the chartered bank accounts from the crazy stuff. Put the crazy stuff in a completely different department. Sort it out and see if something in the garbage you want to save. But put it in a completely different category. Get it out of there. Reverse the bailout. Because the bailout was a swindle against the American people. And I'm sure that a new PCORA commission would have that finding. I have already made that finding, if anybody needed help on that. Proceed that direction. Don't try to compromise language extremely. You just think, make things more complicated. You know, don't cut half of the head off with a guillotine.
Lynn, this question actually is not from the U.S. This is a question that was submitted by an economist who's tasked with advising the State Council of China. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, the trouble to the world economy has been caused mainly by powerful financial interest groups on Wall Street. Within the confines of the U.S. system, how can these groups be constrained, and do they have to be in order to rescue the current economy?
Well, again, on the same thing, I think, you know, we can extend the idea of the PCORA Commission to the claims, the grievances of China. Why not? They belong there, don't they? In the meantime, again, this is my reason on this proposal of the four-power agreement. We four nations, as an initiating group of nations, not four exclusive nations, but four nations which are called together to initiate a general reform for the benefit of humanity. Russia, China, and India, with groups of nations associated with them in this effort. And we have to put the world through reorganization, financial and related reorganization, with a view to launching a general recovery which ensures the security of humanity. For example, if China were to disintegrate, would that have an effect on the security of humanity? All right, China must not disintegrate. And China is being threatened in a way which borders on that. Therefore, the United States has a vital security interest in the security of China. And this is a part of the problem which threatens the security of China. Therefore, the United States, as a friendly nation, is vitally concerned with the security of China to make sure that China is able to function as it should as quickly as possible without any further threat. If we have an extended PCORA Commission, which is what we require, obviously, because the amount of filth and lies and thievery that's been gone on recently under the Bush administration is beyond belief, particularly the last year of the Bush administration. So therefore, the first step is to simply have a gesture from the United States, from the President of the United States, to the government of China, that the United States is expressing its concern for the welfare of China in this matter. That statement of concern can then become operational in various ways. It can lead to discussion, a practical discussion, of ways and means by which China and the United States and other nations can cooperate to prevent this crisis from running out of control. That's the case in which you don't necessarily want to have a specific proposal, because you want to minimize the kind of specific proposals which you make as formal proposals to other countries. In some cases, you have to make a proposal that's formal and specific. In some cases, you don't. In some cases, you simply have to say, we're opening the doors for a discussion of measures of common goodwill, and let's have the discussion. But in this case, I think it's a borderline case. We have to express that concern, and there's a lot on the plate of this newly installed president of that nature, and he requires advisors who just step in on his behalf and according to his will, and express these concerns, because nations will with reasonable patience accept promises from this administration. If it is on some cases doing the work that it promised to do, then that's reason for them to believe that it should have confidence in what it will do, in addition to what it's already done. So the quicker the president gets on to the major things which are important to his administration now, immediately, the more patience he will get from other countries to wait and consult with him on negotiating other things.
We have a pile of questions that I'm not going to be able to get to that came in from legislators across the United States. These are legislators from California, from Michigan, from Florida, from Nevada, from West Virginia, from Kentucky. And in just about every case, one of the things that they do always express is, first of all, the fact that they had worked during the course of the last 2 years for the HBPA, and that they intend to continue to work for that measure. They also invariably have lent their endorsement to Lynn's call for a new PCORA commission. But they also are all addressing the problem of state budgets in extreme distress. And Lynn, I'll just, because California is the biggest problem in this regard, I'll read you just one question along these lines, and you can either answer it specifically or generally as you wish. It is from a member of the California legislature. And he says, I think I know what you're going to say, but I want to hear you say it. I feel that way very often. He says, is there anything that can be done about these ballooning deficits in state governments? While most states are running deficits, California has by far the biggest problem. It's now estimated at a $42 billion shortfall. The governor insists that this must be covered by budget cuts and disguised tax increases, and that nothing else can be discussed until this is resolved. Meanwhile, desperate members of the legislature are now appealing to President Obama for a bailout of the magnitude of that offered Citibank. The problem is that the state will run out of cash reserves by next week. What can we do?
Well, I think we need a California Recall Commission. I think the popularity of the governor is at a low point about this time. Now, we have to have, especially between the executive, the federal executive, and relevant people in California, there has to be a discussion. Now, I don't know how Mrs. Blasey is going to treat this thing, because she's been one of the major problems in this. And she is said to be from California, though I understand she's actually from Maryland, or maybe from some other place called Hunger. But this, so there should be a negotiation on this. right away. This is an emergency. There's no question of it. But unfortunately, the governor himself is the emergency. I mean, the guy has a pedigree from Austria, which is not exactly the most reassuring, shall we say. His father is a leading Nazi official. I mean, it's not exactly. And he's acting like one in California. So I don't think that we can be soft on that. No, there has to be. There obviously has to be an action, and it has to come largely from Washington, from the executive branch. And there one thing you can do is a president can encourage people to do something. Even if he can't do it himself, he says, "You do it, and I'll back you up. I'll support you." And I think this is one of those cases. We cannot have California sliding off like the fault into the Pacific Ocean. We can throw the governor into the ocean if the fish don't object too much. But I'm very serious about that. We have to do something. And the point is to make it clear that we intend to do something. And I think also a number of measures simultaneously unleashed, such as an immediate recall motion for the governor. That is a minimum thing that has to be started. And then gestures of goodwill. And then also then an alternative. And to put the state into bankruptcy protection. And maybe federal bankruptcy protection. Federal receivership, if necessary. And that would do it. Put them into receivership, put the governor in recall, and get some credit in there for worthwhile credit, because 42 is not that big when you consider what happened in Wall Street recently. So to bail out a whole state is worthwhile if that's going to stabilize the situation for the nation. And a combination of such measures, an array of such measures, open up with a battery of artillery fire and see what that does.
Okay. Once again, I have to apologize for the fact that we're not going to get to all of the questions. I'm going to read a short statement that came in from Assemblyman Jerry Claiborne from the Nevada State Legislature, just because it captures statements that we've gotten in from so many others. And then I will ask Lynn one final question to wrap things up. But again, I apologize for the fact that we could not even entertain all of the institutional questions. And I know Lynn will try to get to them in time. I also apologize to you guys for my voice, but I had the honor of representing Lynn at the inauguration on Tuesday, but that also entailed sitting outside in the freezing cold for 4 hours, perfectly still. So that actually one of the things that they did, it's apparently a tradition among the VIPs and dignitaries who were gathered. You're asked to write in this book what your favorite part of the inaugural ceremony was. I wrote my favorite part was when Bush and Cheney left. And I felt confident in speaking for Lynn on that. Lynn, the statement from Assemblyman Claiborne is as follows. He says, "Mr. LaRouche, my question is more in the form of a statement. I wanted to say that I wholeheartedly support your call for convening new PCORA hearings. It is long overdue. The party's over. The public are dead set against the banks and hopefully will not stand for any more bailouts. We've had enough. The well is dry. These bankers should be put on trial. The evidence is right there in front of us. Look at the shape of the nation. We are a wreck. They, the Madoffs, the Soroses, and others, have killed the American dream. That is all the proof we need. Only an animal would do what the Wall Street boys have done. They're like Jesse James or John Dillinger without guns. march them off to jail, just as you said. I've been a union organizer for over 25 years, and now I serve in the state legislature. I built bridges and power plants, and now these guys are tearing everything down. I support your call for PCORA hearings in the Congress. I know that many of my colleagues do as well. The only question is, what are we waiting for? Otherwise, some guy sent in this question that I can answer. It'll take 2 seconds. He says, as Webster Tarpley tells us, Obama is a puppet in the hands of Brzezinski. And according to Webster Tarpley, Obama will set up conflict and war against Russia and China. Is this true? No. And then the final question comes from one of the people who is coordinating the transition. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, over these last months, you've been extremely generous in providing not only the context in which this new administration must consider its policies, but you've shared detailed analysis and specific policy initiatives. Your input has been invaluable, and we'd like you to know that it has been greatly appreciated. If this very afternoon you had a few moments to give advice directly to the president, what would you say to him?
Well, I would say the things I've said today, above all. This is a time where I know this feeling of this kind of situation. I understand the situation he's in, probably in some ways better than he does. Being older and having lived through this world longer, and probably having more influence in terms of on me from various parts of the world, that I can feel strongly the effect in various parts of the world of what the world has been subjected to under the U.S. toleration of the British Empire. And that's the best way to put it. That the president has been given, as I believe others would assure him, he's been given a moment as president when his popularity is at the very height, probably the highest it will ever be, because there are frictional things in being president which tend to tear down some of your popularity around the edges on one grievance or another, or one issue or another. And this is the time to make a couple of decisions which are crucial, and I think they have to be made up front. First, we have to deal ruthlessly and decisively with this world monetary, financial, economic crisis. We have to establish again the position of the United States in the specific tradition of President Franklin Roosevelt. To act as Roosevelt would have done had he lived beyond the time of his death into the conclusion of the war, which he led in winning. And I think at this point, President Obama has inherited that legacy from the deceased Franklin Roosevelt to pick up the world from a period of decline and despair by taking a decisive action which, above all other things, establishes the United States in the opinion of leaders of the world as being the leader of nations out of the darkness to which we have lived in recent times up to this point. I think that the general economic reform, including that of cooperation extended toward Russia, China, and India, is crucial. But to make that work, we must first make a sweeping reform in the U.S. credit system. We must establish, as Roosevelt intended, a fixed exchange rate system of credit not a monetary system, but a credit system, among a number of leading nations of the world, including our own United States, Russia, China, and India. And around this group of leading nations, to lead the world into a general economic reform with the kind of objectives which I've referred to today. We have to take mankind out of this abyss which we've been sliding into more and more and more since Franklin Roosevelt died, and especially since 1967-68. We've got to get back. And we've got to recognize also in our actions that the United States, whether some people like to hear it or not, the United States is the greatest nation which has ever existed. Not because of something magical about it, but because we are the representatives of what we call the melting pot nation, of the hopes of the people of the world. We were what they hoped would become their destiny, that what we would achieve would become available to them for their benefit. And the President of the United States, I think, must express that in practical ways as well as in voice to the world as a whole. He must be again seen as we saw President Franklin Roosevelt during World War II, as a man who took a leading position in a leading nation in saving the world from hell. And certainly President Obama is faced with a challenge of approximately that magnitude. And I think he needs all the support he can get on that account.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this brings today's proceedings to a close. I think we can, in a sense, end where we began. We are out of the bushes, but we're not out of the woods. However, the good news is that we have an excellent guide. And if, in fact, we utilize that guide, we will make it out of the woods very safely. Thank you, and get out there and get to work. We should thank Lynn again, I think.